Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News and to KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland. This is Totality of Circumstances, a show that focuses on policing from a holistic and community perspective. My name is Sam Bowman. I am usually joined by Jasmine Moneymaker, but she is out this week. On January 6th of this year, a legally blind man named Andre Gladden was shot and killed by a Portland police officer after being discharged from Adventist Hospital in East Portland while in the midst of a mental health crisis. This coming Saturday, July 6th, members of his family are traveling up from California to celebrate his life on the six-month anniversary of his death. The event is being organized by the family, along with members of Pacific Northwest Family Circle, a group of families who have lost loved ones to police violence. The group frequently holds what they call angelversaries, celebrations of life for those they have lost that also function as a way to keep their calls for justice in the public consciousness. Members of Gladden's family came to Portland near the end of February to meet with Mayor Wheeler and Police Chief Outlaw on what turned out to be the same day that a county grand jury declined to indict the officer who killed Andre. I spoke to Donna Martin, Andre Gladden's sister, back in June. What follows is the first part of the interview. The rest will be posted shortly on the Totality of Circumstances page at kboo.fm. So the angelversary for the six-month anniversary for Andre is coming up on July 6th. Can you tell me a little bit about where that's going to be and what's going to be happening that day?
On July 6th, we're going to have the angelversary for my brother Andre. It'll be located near the entrance of Adventist Hospital. It's on the 9600 block of Southeast Market in Portland, Oregon. Other family members from Pacific Northwestern Family Circle will be joining us in solidarity and reverence of Andre. We will definitely have some balloons, posters, flyers, in reverence and just going back to, you know, that moment. As you all know, the family was not in Portland, Oregon, the day that this occurred. But we definitely want to keep the memory of Andre alive as best as possible. So that's why we refer to the angelversary to celebrate his life. And with the support of other family members doing the same. So we all try to support each other when days like this, like those approach. So we're definitely doing it in reverence of Andre.
Yeah, and you mentioned that several family members are traveling up from various parts of California. Could you tell us a bit about Andre and just how you and your family remember him?
We remember Andre as the life of the party type guy. If we didn't have something or we couldn't get something, he's always a way maker. He's super talented. He'd sing, he'd rap, he'd, you know, interact with the family. He's always a caring guy. He wants to know what's on your mind all the time. He goes in depth with a conversation just to see who you are and how you're doing type guy. He surrounds himself with friends periodically, friends that he grew up with in, you know, elementary school, or friends that he's hung with in school. So he made friends everywhere that he got. There's not a person that I've been aware of that met Andre and didn't, you know, take liking to him. So he's always super open. Andre is the type of guy, like I said, with him being legally blind, a lot of times he couldn't identify a specific dollar amount in which he had on his pocket. Not everyone knew of his, because he has the left eye still visible and the right eye completely removed. Not everyone knew that he was legally blind in both eyes. And for his safety, he preferred it be that way, just for his protection. But not oftentimes he'd be able to, you know, hand out, you know, a dollar and know that it's a dollar, a $5 and know that's what it is. It didn't matter what he had in his pocket. If he had it and someone asked for it, he'd pull it out. It didn't matter what it was. He was giving that way. He was open that way. Andre loved life, period. There's nothing with his personality. A lot of people, when I have the conversation with them, what did he do is something that comes up. And that's not a question. Well, it is a question for those who are not aware and completely aware of police brutality. But in this situation, it's clear that there was nothing negatively done by him that caused this type of reaction. Andre asked for help, and if asking for help is a crime, then by gosh, we should all, you know, tape our lips closed.
Yeah, and I want to ask you, you've met, you and several other of your family members have met with Mayor Wheeler of Portland and Chief Daniel Outlaw. Do you get the impression that they understand that, what you were just describing, how this affects families as well as the people who were there at the scene?
In all honesty and having empathy for a situation, just seeing it, I got the impression from them that they told me exactly what the family wanted to hear. What you would say to anybody, whether they're ill, oh, I hope you get well, or something of that nature. It was just a repetitive surface response to what occurred. Obviously, if you've lost a loved one, I would, you know, send out my condolences, but actually truly interested in how do we bring this person to justice, being as though bringing this person to justice requires placing one of your police officers in handcuffs. That was not something they were willing to do. When Danielle and Chief of Police and Outlaw, the mayor, stated that we're going to bring this person to justice, they will indeed suffer the consequences of their actions. They meant that. They meant that if it was not one of their officers. But the fact that it is one of their officers, he was completely not held responsible for his actions. They were completely, they looked to be sympathetic to the situation. I personally asked Miss Outlaw, if this were her children, if you would put your child or your husband, your spouse, one of your loved ones in the shoes of Andre Gladden on January 6th, would you, in your position, allow this to slide or look away? And obviously her answer was no. But because this happened to be one of the officers beneath you, we can shun away from it and say that, oh, this was justified because of qualified immunity. There was no threat per the officer. There was no threat per Andre to the witness's house in which he arrived at. She identified her having children, African-American children, that she totally understands what this is about. She totally understands in the event that she should lose them in such a manner, that of our anger and our frustration, our willingness to get the answers. But my question to her was very direct, and still she did not answer my question. But I need for them to understand that this is not just because you have African American children, that has nothing to do with the situation. This has to do with the de-escalation techniques that they were trained to perform in the field in which they didn't. This has nothing to do with black and white. This has to do with the moral compass of the officers that they are letting patrol our streets. These officers that I'm made aware of, they do not live in Portland, Oregon. They are outside individuals from a totally different community coming to patrol a community that they have no knowledge, history, or legacy of the people, of the members of the community that reside there. So if you place these officers back into their communities, they would behave much differently as they do on and off camera. But for this to occur under their watch, knowing the history that a multitude of these officers have and their demeanor, whether it's a police-involved shooting or excessive force, it's not proper. It's not proper. It's not ethical. It's not lawful to patrol in the manner in which they do. As far as I'm made aware, the officers are not drug test in screening. There should be some type of screening as you would apply for a job. They do a background check on you. So when this officer goes and have lies, has the ability to play judge, jury, and executioner all in one second and eliminate that victim or that person from their due time in court to be justified before the court, the officer completely removes him of that that right. And I hear a lot of people that continue to say, well, the officers need to be trained. They need to be trained. Well, the officers are trained. They're trained to do what they're doing. They patrol our streets as if this is a game. We get no do-overs because you mistake a phone for a gun, or you mistake a flashlight for a baton, or you mistake these different types of instruments for weapons. But what's extremely odd for me is that these officers are on duty and they man weapons all day, every day, batons, guns, knives, tasers. How do you constantly mistake a cellular device for a gun when you're holding these weapons all day? You should be able to know the feel, the look of them, the distance in which you can identify a person, whether their hands up or they're running or their back is turned. All these mistakes are too many mistakes that are causing individuals their lives. And after you discover this was indeed not a weapon, you go and use qualified immunity to say, I didn't know, or it was a mistake. Because it was a mistake, we don't get to press the reset button and bring our loved ones back. That's definitely a huge thing for me. If we have the ability to change bills and policies that are in place. The people put these people in place to govern over our families and make sure that we are served and protected justifiably under the law. But if the law is not upholding the law or using common sense or their moral compass to do what they were sworn under oath to do, then I think that they need to remove themselves.
You mentioned the issue of de-escalation and how officers, and particularly Portland officers, fail to interact well or even proactively with people who are experiencing a mental health or a cognitive crisis. And I wanted to ask you if you're willing to tell me a little bit about how Andre experienced the illness that he had, and how that might have played into the situation that he was in that day.
Andre, I believe I briefly went over it for a moment yesterday, but Andre suffered his schizophrenia bipolar throughout a trial of loss prior to the loss of his vision. He did suffer the loss of his eldest brother in 2000, in which I believe Andre was maybe about 13. 18 years old, Andre suffered the loss of his older cousin that he held to high regards. He was also murdered by the Pittsburgh police in 1997. These drastic changes within his life caused him to go into a spiral depression. It caused him to a little bit isolate himself for a moment. He was still Andre, but very cautious and very protective of his actions, his movements, how he would act in the presence of officers. Andre was always fully cooperative if there had to be an encounter, whether he had anything to do with it or not. He knew how to maneuver in front of them in their presence, being fully compliant to whatever, you know, demands that they would issue or compliance that they would issue. So even with the mental aspect, Andre was still mentally there. He, like I said, he would go into spiral depressions up and down. He did. We did seek medical attention for him, in which he received medical service attention. He was placed on medication for a while as well, but there would be times to where he refused to take it because he's under the, okay, it's working, I don't need it anymore, but it's working because you're taking it. So trying to get, you know, get him to understand that. So every now and again, we would have those types of episodes. Andre with paranoia, schizophrenia, Andre has developed some form of PTSD early on due to the loss, due to all of the losses being, he had nightmares of his brother, nightmares of his cousin being brutally murdered. So there's a lot of things that took place that caused him to be the mental state that he was on January 6th. Now, with him taking or not taking his medication at this time, we were not fully made aware of why or how he was transported to Adventist Hospital or what the cause was for him being transported to Adventist Hospital. There are some circulating information that we, and I don't know how truthful, or I don't have documentation of those new evidence being completely true. So once I do receive a solid proof that that is true, then I'd be more than happy to share that with you. But at this time, I can't deem that they're factual statements.
Okay.
But Andre's behavior, mental state on that day did not cause this to happen. Andre mentioned three very important things to the witness when he arrived to the house between 1 and 2. He stated he had just been released from the hospital. He had his hospital gown protruding from his shirt and a wristband on, which solidified the fact that he was being honest. He said that I needed help, that he's not there to harm, but he's there to receive aid of some sort. He stated that somebody's after me trying to kill me. Again, that's where the schizophrenia sets in place. The witness whose door he knocked at, he explained, Andre stated this to him. They had a conversation between 5 and 7 minutes of what Andre was experiencing. I don't know if Andre, if he just offered a glass of water, but he gave Andre a glass of water and offered Andre $3 to $10 to catch the MAX train. I wasn't aware of what the MAX train was, but apparently it's public transportation for Portland, Oregon.
Yeah.
So Andre declined the money. He said, I need more help than that. And the guy said, well, you can't come here. You can't come in the house. Andre made a comment as to, since he can't come in, the witness says that, well, you can rest on the porch for 5 or 10 minutes. So the water was brought to Andre. The witness goes out the back door to where the landlord of the property lived. So this unit that Andre arrived to has the 18 occupants. On this particular day, this one individual was there. I don't know if it's a halfway house or what type of situation that's there, but he's the only one. who was at the home at this particular day. Desmond brought Andre the water, went out to the back to talk to the landlord to let her know what was going on. And this conversation took place maybe five to six minutes, in which he advised her, this black guy is at my house. He looks, you know, this way, you know, that way. So she advises him to call the authorities. And so Desmond leaves to make this phone call. I don't know if he was still present with her or he left to go in the house. But two phone calls were placed. She advised him to place the call to police. She called the police, and Desmond went into the house, and he also called the police. Now, it's very important as to what verbiage was displayed on this call, because that allows the officer to be partially informed, as much as possible, informed as to what he's going to encounter. Now, the DA grand jury has determined that those transcripts from the call is not important. It is 1,000% important, because that lets the officer know how he needs to respond and what manner to approach the situation. So we have not received transcripts from this call, and we're still fighting to get that information. So as Desmond comes back into the home, he sits. And a few moments passes by, and Andre is banging on his door. Desmond gets up and goes to open the door, yelling at Andre, "Get the F off my property, get the F off." And Andre, it was actually the transcript states that Andre was asleep on the porch when the officer approached him. And he was awakened from his sleep by this officer and began banging on the door, where Desmond opens the door, and he opens the door and begins to yell at Andre. Andre is stating that this is not a police, I don't know who the F this is. Mind you, Andre is already under the impression that someone's trying to kill him, that somebody's after him. So Andre does not identify that this is a police officer. This was an unmarked car, a police without uniform. And Andre does not know whether he has a gun at him or not. He's legally blind. He cannot see. The officer states that he pointed to his badge, and Andre appeared to look in that direction. Now, me visibly being able to look in the direction, me hearing in which direction the voice is coming from, I'm able to redirect my attention, not solely eye to eye, as he didn't have that ability. But that's what the officer is stating. So Andre is in fear of his life. He's trying to get away from this person who states that he is the police, and he's stuck in the middle of the witness who's telling him, "Get the F off my property. This is the police, because I called them." And it doesn't matter for us to know that whether he was in uniform or not. The point is that Andre is legally blind, and he is unable to identify that this is an officer. So Andre pushes past the witness. He falls on his hands and knees in the entryway of the door. With that happening, the officer is trying to subdue Andre to get him cuffed. He couldn't do so, so he asks the witness to assist him in apprehending Andre. The witness stated that, "I don't know if it was wrong, but I placed my foot on his neck to ensure that he didn't get away." So the officer is roughly about 250 so pounds. The witness himself is about close to 280, 300 pounds. Andre is 5'6", 146 in weight. So with that happening, you're fighting for your life, not sure of what's going on. I could only imagine that his adrenaline would be to the highest limit at this point. Based on what this report is stating, is that the officer was on Andre's back with the foot of the witness on his neck, and his hands were, they were trying to cuff him. What he's saying is that Andre freed himself from that position. It states that he kicked the officer in his sternum while he was on his stomach, which caused the officer to fall back into a bedroom that is off from the living room, off from the kitchen. It's a complete open floor plan. So there was some tussling and moving throughout this situation. So the officer is saying that as he was kicked in his sternum, it caused him to fly backwards. And where Andre was able to get up, the witness says he didn't see Andre pull a knife. He didn't see where the knife came from, only that it just appeared. So Andre charged the officer with the knife, to where he issued out several commands, stop or I'll tase you, stop or I'll tase you. He shot Andre with the taser. He said to no avail, but Andre fell on his rear and the knife dropped to his right, is what they're stating. He gets back up, finds wherever this knife is, and charges him again. He issues out several commands, and then he fires three times. Two hit Andre in his chest area, lung, I believe both shots in the right lung. The third bypassed the witness and hit the wall. The officer says that Andre fell to his feet. I mean, it fell to the officer's feet. He stepped over Andre because he felt as though that he was lifeless at this point and was no longer a threat. He stepped over him to see the knife, because he familiarized himself with it. Oh, that looks familiar. So he picks up the knife, looks at it, and stabs it in the ground. He then states that he considered Andre no longer a threat. He called for, at this point, and to the transcript states that the officers arrived 30 to 45 seconds to a minute after the shooting had occurred, when prior on this statement that he called for backup prior to entering the home. But they had not arrived until after the fact. Andre was on the ground. As the other officers and investigators arrived, prior to their arrival, Desmond, which is a witness, also touched, he walked around the house, he picked up the knife, walked around the home for, it says a moment in the statement, and placed the knife exactly back in that location. Now, there are not three stab wounds, there's not three protrusions into the flooring, there's only one, stating that they carefully placed this knife back in its position. The responding officers and responding investigators saw this knife. After Andre was shot, I'm going to back up a little bit. After Andre was shot, Andre was turned over and handcuffed to secure the perimeter to ensure that the surrounding areas were safe and there was no one else in the home. As the responding officers came, the investigators and the EMT arrived, they instructed the officers to remove the cuffs to administer life-saving techniques. One of the investigators, I won't say his name, instantly saw the knife sticking out of the floor. So he positioned himself in that area to ensure that it was not tampered with. Unbeknownst to him, it had already been tampered with twice. So he stood closely to this knife, And one of the things that was very obvious was because this officer was trained to perform based on this type of situation, we would know to not tamper with the evidence. Why the officer picked it up, his response was that he was familiar with the knife. So that was his reason for picking it up. Desmond gave no reason. However, that information was leaked that he touched and held that knife and placed it back voluntarily. He mistakenly said that, yeah, I touched the knife. So that was not information that was that they asked him, but that he volunteered to share that information. So that's why there's no, they didn't display the forensic finding of the amount of fingerprints that were on the knife, only that the prints belonged to the three of them. This officer had no idea that Andre was legally blind. He stated that it appeared that Andre's right eye was disheveled, not leveled, that he saw the eye. The thing that is completely absurd is that Andre had no eye there. It was removed back in 2017. So there's no way that you could have seen that if that eye was not there. The eye, the lid has no way of staying open. There's no eye there. So Andre was, after they administered life-saving techniques, Andre did pass in that house. The EMT rolled him over to see the entry and exit wounds, and he gasped for, you know, a final breath at that moment. There was no, they lifted up his shirt, checked his hand. There's no laceration on his waistband. There's no lacerations on either right or left hand. He's right-handed. There's no lacerations anywhere. So what we're trying to understand is the officer stated that he allowed the media to believe that this knife belonged to Andre. Later on, he did not fully participate in the investigation. He instantly sought out for his personal lawyer, who advised, due to confidentiality, that he will not state whether the knife belonged to him or to Andre. Nobody saw Andre pull the knife from anywhere. The knife just appeared. That too was awfully alarming. But he states that later on he releases a report that says, due to the findings, the knife did belong to the officer. Now there's this policy put in place newly to the Portland Police Department and several other places that the officers are now no longer to hold this knife on their tactical vest to where someone would be able to assess it. But the thing is, how would Andre know that this knife is there? If he never got close to the officer, how would he know that the knife is there to retrieve it from his vest, allow it to fall and search for it again and charge him again when you have an officer, you have Andre, and you have a witness? If he constantly is trying to approach, you assisted in trying to apprehend Andre. There was so many opportunities to, if the knife fell, for someone to grab the knife before this happened. And that's why when the report came out, we instantly knew that the knife did not belong to Andre. It's not something that he would carry. Andre is not known for, he's a pretty slim guy and pants are always fitted. If in the event that he needed something to uphold his pants, it would be a string or something of that sort. He just doesn't wear a belt. To be able to man this knife, it has to have a holster because it is a double-edged blade. It's a martial arts type weapon. Perry's 6 inches in length. And to be able to man it, you would have to have some type of holster to hold it, or if Andre was to locate it on the ground to physically pick it up, he would have cut himself. There's no documents of any cuts. There's no, they only booked the knife into evidence, but not a holster. The holster was on the tactical vest, something that you slide into place, but you have to flip open the tab to grab this knife.
Mm-hmm.
Grand jury asked the officer, well, where was this knife stationed? He didn't know. He had no idea. Where was this knife at this point? Well, it must have been my knife because it was missing from my holster. He said that he manned two knives on that day, one in his holster and one in his khaki, but he had no idea where they were located. For you to be an officer responding to a call such as this, you figure that you'd have, you know where your tools are if in case you needed to use them. So in this grand jury report, it does not tell us whose all fingerprints was on the knife, but three fingerprints belonging to three separate people, Desmond, the officers, and Andre. And I say that he had no idea that he was blind was because he planted that knife on Andre. And there was no statement of Andre actually pulling, or anybody actually seeing Andre pulling the knife from his person. Andre was transported from the home, covered up in a blanket as though he had, as though he was already deceased. So the amount of time in which he was able to be revived is unknown. But as Andre was leaving the location on the gurney covered, an officer reported that he was still alive, but he was covered as though he had passed again. So we're not extremely clear about that. At this time, during this altercation, there's only three people present. Consider Vasu, the officer, Desmond Piscaya, the witness, Andre Gladden, the victim. There was no other witnesses but the two. February 22nd, the grand jury questioned 13 witnesses. We're wondering, where did all these witnesses come from? These officers, responding officers and responding investigators, surrounding neighbors that heard but did not visibly see anything, are now named witnesses. However, they were not present during this time, so we're questioning how are they able to be solidified as actual witnesses in all sense of not being present at that time. Now, we have witnesses that are surrounding neighbors that tell the story of the character of the witness, how irate he was in response to Andre asking for help, and how a couple of the witnesses stated this is natural behavior for this particular witness. Andre happened to knock at the wrong door. He just happened to knock at the wrong door for help. There's no way that he would have known that. The route between the hospital and this home was a very short walk, about 5 minutes for you and I, but for a blind individual that pursuit to this location could be a little bit more lengthier time.
Mm-hmm.
These grand jury transcripts that come out, either it's the judge or the DA is asking open-ended questions and not receiving valid responses to the question. So, which leads me to believe there is a ton of information that is redacted, and it's not being transparent on these documents. This police officer was new to the force, about really shy of 2 years on the force. So I wouldn't say that he's a vet in the field. However, he made several mistakes when it comes to responding officers. For a lot of the arrests happen to be members, mentally ill members of the community, or they suffer from some type of mental illness or disability. In hindsight, the thing that we can do to make sure that this does not happen again is that we need some sort of a crisis team to, if a call is sent out in a certain manner, someone needing assistance for someone with mental illness, there is a specific training that is given for a crisis team that is not fully explored by the police department throughout. A crisis team would be someone who has the mental and physical and license to approach a situation. People that have schizophrenia or bipolar, they should be approached in such a way, not guns pointed, weapons ablazing. There's a certain verbiage that needs to be used, a certain calmness that needs to be utilized in approaching these individuals. If the police are to be the first responders, there needs to be some sort of crisis team that will help bridge that gap. And if the crisis team are not able to perform to get a response, at least apprehend them or either send them to jail or send them to where they need some mental health assistance, then they can do that. But if that does not happen, then that's where the police should come into play. But using a firearm on a person who is mentally ill, they may not have, depending on the illness, they may not have that ability to verbally comply or physically comply, or they could have some form of autism and unable to perform these services. But if I'm unable to comply to your demand, that does not solidify a person resisting arrest. If I'm mentally or physically unable to perform this service, it's hard for them to say, oh, my life was in danger. The officer's life was never in danger. He wielded the weapon. Desmond stated that Andre did not appear to be a threat when he approached his door. He also stated that Andre did not appear to know where he was. He also stated that Andre did not talk to him, but at him. There was no eye contact, but he spoke in the direction of his voice. That was clear on the transcript. The statement has changed from the day of the altercation. The witness has been contacted a multitude of times to have the opportunity to change his story. And I say that to make clear that when the story was just released, it went from the witness trying to assist Andre in the best way that he can. Why did this happen to this man? This is not the reason I called. It's unfortunate that this happened. I feel sorry for him. However, days later, he was visited by, obviously there's an ongoing investigation now, but where he's spending time with different investigators. He's being coerced to say certain things, to change certain information. And that notice is apparent. Going from article to article, his story continues to change. The first article stated that Andre kicked Desmond in his sternum, and he ran and fled the house and sat on the porch gasping for air. But the second article states that Andre kicked the officer in his sternum, which caused him to be cornered in the back room. So the story continues to change. The officer stated, and I'm going back into now there's new information from the time of the encounter,
yeah,
grand jury transcript that states the officer had Andre, although Andre fell on his hands and knees, Andre's body was positioned left hip to the ceiling, right palm on the ground, pushing him away with his left hand. But he grabs the officer's knife with his right hand that is already on the ground. So you see, these things are not making sense. So you have the witness's statement of what transpired, and then you have the officer's view of what transpired. Those two stories are not conducive to each other. They're clashing, and it continues to happen. So what I want to happen is for the truth to be told. There's no way that the family can ever receive closure without knowing. And I am a huge believer that we'll never hear the actual story, but we do know the results of this officer's actions. We have to live out the fact that he's no longer here because of the moral compass. The witness continued to state that he wasn't going to close the door because he's not going to be responsible for what happens next. Like, what did you mean by that? What information was the officer given to be able to respond appropriately?
So at this point, I'd like to jump in and remind our listeners that you're listening to the voice of Donna Martin, who is the sister of Andre Gladden, who was shot and killed by Portland police officer Kunsider Vosu in January of 2019. At this point in the interview, we were interrupted by some technical difficulties, and we're forced to finish the interview the last 15 minutes or so over a cell phone, so that is the reason for the drastic change in sound quality. And now back to Donna Martin.
Okay, Donna, you were explaining some of the discrepancies in the testimony that was given by the witness and some of the conflicting information and lack of information that you've been given.
Right.
But I also wanted to ask, like, from January 5th onward, what sort of information were you given as the family, as, like, the next of kin?
So we were given pretty minimal information. The way that we were made aware, Andre had a cellular device in which he would travel with here and there, and we would stay in communication with him. However, on this particular day, Andre had no cell phone, but there was a phone number for my cousin in which he was visiting here in Portland. Her phone number was in his pocket. Now, that was odd as well. It seems as though, now, the information that I've been made aware is that the police called my cousin on this because the number was in his possession, and she is not completely mentally all the way coherent. So she's not mentally stable at all. So there were several calls placed to her advising her of what had occurred, and she continued to hang up the call stating that this was a joke. Somebody was joking with her. Being the severity, I'm not going to take that information lightly, but as far as I've made aware, the call was placed to the equivalent of 4 to 5 times. Letting her know what had transpired. So until that information sought in, I don't know who it. I believe they then attempted to contact his father, in which that's how the family got the information here in Portland. And Andre's stepmother placed a call to us back home to advise us what had occurred. So Andre, the information was conveyed to us via family after the failed attempts from, it could be the officer, the investigator, or the hospital. I'm not quite certain as to who placed the call, but I know that they tried to contact my cousin. This is also one of the people that are named as a witness to the murder and execution of Andre. I don't want to completely slam her character due to the fact that she is not mentally competent to be a witness or to speak on behalf of the situation due to her own disadvantages. However, I feel as though the reporters knew this and the grand jury knew that some inkling that her mental state was not of average, and they continue to manipulate her to say certain things, and which was expressed in the grand jury report as well. So her story, too, has changed. And again, this is family, so it's very disheartening. So her story has changed with the reporters, as well as getting to the grand jury transcript. Desmond is known to be a police informant, in which his story has been changed. So in all fairness, I believe that these witnesses or people that claim to be witnesses are being coerced into saying and changing the story to fit the lack of indictment or justification for the murder of Andre Gladden.
There's an article that I came across talking about how some members of the family had planned to file a lawsuit. This was from back in February. Is that still?
That is in its concluding stages at this moment.
And what that was against the city of Portland?
That was, yes, sir.
Are you, I'm guessing you probably aren't able to talk too much about ongoing litigation.
Not at this moment, no.
Okay. You are currently in Portland for another another Angelversary for Patrick Kimmons, which is tomorrow. And then we'll be coming back for the July 6th event. So you've connected with other families in the city who have had this experience, and I'm wondering what sort of changes would you like to see? You talked a little bit about making sure that training actually reaches officers and that their officers are screened, but what do you think could be changed, like around the way that information is given to families and to the public?
A transparency, of course, the way that the information was delivered to my mother in regards to whether an indictment was towards the officer or not. That call was placed via the DA as we were en route to Portland. My mother has a health issue, health concern, and the way that that information was conveyed to us in regards to my brother was very discouraging, disheartening, and disrespectful. So there has to be a way that we communicate, and with them all knowing, the DA knowing, the mayor, the chief of police knowing that we were currently en route, this could have been something that should have been conveyed to us at the time in the meeting in which we met with the mayor. But I believe they orchestrated it perfectly to fit the best ability of their situation and the front face that they wanted to portray to the media. So definitely getting that information over to the families properly. There is also a family who received information via the newspaper. No contact by the police, no contact by the DA. It was that is the complete disregard for the lack of empathy and transparency that the families need to receive. We definitely would not have to have these calls placed, but to not be informed at all hours to weeks or days later is completely inappropriate. So getting the information over is one. Transparency is another. The accountability of the police officers, how they need to conduct themselves. And if we're talking about being accountable, if law enforcement would like for an individual that they encounter on the street to be accountable for their actions, whether a crime is committed or not, to be accountable for them and serve their due time, we ask that the officers, the community asks that the officers also to be held accountable. You cannot demand this type of service from us, and you are not able to provide that same to the community. If we're talking about accountability, it needs to be across the board. In regards to the police brutality, it's clearly not a black or white thing. This is the incompetency of law enforcement and their authority. There's a chip on the shoulder. So when we, a lot of individuals that I know, other individuals that have not encountered police brutality, there is a fear that hovers when you're being approached by police officers because of what they've been known to do in the past and how they conduct themselves today. If they approach individuals with us in a certain manner, I believe that everyone can go home in a timely manner or serve their time in due court to be sentenced appropriately, not judge, jury, and executioner all in one second. So there's changes that has to be and it has to be made, and the communities are fighting throughout the country to make sure certain bills are passed regarding excessive force and using their other options before fatally taking someone's life. So the qualified immunity is more of a shield that they are used when these law enforcement go out and commit criminal acts. So the community understands that criminals also wear badges and wear blue. They just don't know that we are we're hip to the plan. We understand that the light has been given for them to do what they're doing, and we want to let them know that we understand that. We see that. But aside from, you know, catching our loved ones in the street, we'd rather fight in court to justify a resistance or anything to that nature. These individuals have no way. If the officer can take your life and claim immunity and fear of their life, what repercussion does the victim have to save his own life? There has to be a way for both, not just, you know, qualified immunity for law enforcement. If my life is threatened, what action am I legally allowed to take and receive no jail time for? The same as these officers, they're murdering family members in the street and they leave on paid vacation. When these type of things happen, I feel that pension is in place. That paid vacation needs to be forwarded to the family to help, to partially assist with the burial of their loved ones. They should be, yeah, suspended without pay. That's a reward for them. Some of these officers know how this goes. They not some of them, they know how this goes. And you don't have competent people in place or people with moral ethics in place. A lot of individuals, they know what's going on. We know what's wrong and right, and still we choose to do the wrong thing. These uniforms are placed on evil people that have no regards for their lives. We don't know what's happening in the home or the day in the life of the police officer, but wearing my skin and wearing their suit, it's the same thing. It's the same exact thing. To have to walk out of your home and know that you're instantly a threat because of the color of your skin or what class of life you come from, that's unheard of. It shouldn't be a thing. And for qualified immunity to even be in place is absurd for me, because if we're doing justice and we're acting in ordinance and coordinating under the law, everyone needs to be held accountable. So qualified immunity serves as a blanket for human error in which life is not brought back after we've determined that this is an error. This is a way to allow them to do what they do and claim qualified immunity. I believe we should all be held accountable for our actions, rather black, blue, white, brown, or purple.
So I wanted to say again that coming up on July 6th is going to be the 6-month angelversary for Andre Gladden, and that's going to be at Adventist Health Center in Portland at 10123 Southeast Market Street. And Don, I've been to one or two of these events in the past, and I know that they can be a combination of celebration and protest and rally. And I just want, if people are going to come out to this event, what would you like them to know before they arrive?
I would like them to know that they're welcomed to stand in solidarity in support of the family, that this is something in reverence of his life. Everything that has needed to be spoken has been spoken. The community is aware, the nation is aware. So this is solely just to reverence his life. And to if there is anyone that is oblivious to police brutality or have not encountered it, this is a result of police brutality or gun violence. So I encourage them to either find out information on how they can better educate their loved ones in the presence of authority, or educate their family members of how to conduct themselves, how to be transparent in their actions, and how we can end police brutality or try. I believe we can. It's just the fight in which each individual has to put forth to make sure that it doesn't happen. But they are definitely welcome to stand with the family, and we support all the families, whether this has happened or not. People need to be prepared. They need to educate their loved ones on how not to have to stand in the street and hold a sign of your loved ones and weep and cry endlessly about a situation that didn't have to be. So we definitely welcome the support.
And is there anything else that you would like to add or that you would like people to know before we wrap up?
That Andre was not murdered due to his actions. Andre was murdered due to the lack of police accountability. And each individual of the community should be made aware of what's going on in today's society and understand that the authority in which the police officers are to uphold are not actually displayed out in our streets. And we need to be aware, we understand that there are some good officers out there. And if the good officers would stand out, the community will support them. I understand that that's a huge sacrifice because they will too be targeted. But we can't make it right if we don't get the other side to see the fault, to see the breaks in the system. We're going to need law enforcement to change law enforcement. So we need people that have hearts and not just weapons, and use their other tools aside from just their weapons. So that is my message to the community. I definitely support and give my condolences to all the families that have been affected by police brutality, and unity will allow us to further make progress in having these officers be held accountable.
Donna, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today and yesterday, and for being very patient with the technical difficulties that we've had.
Not a problem. I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to share Andre's message.